Dave Dellinger has been one of the key leaders of the anti-war movement and the movement for social justice in this country for about 40 years.
In the Depression, there was also a lot of exposure about the arms merchants, the merchants of death. Woodrow Wilson had said in a speech that, is there any man, woman, or child in America, any child who does not know that this was an industrial and commercial war relating to World War I? But also in the course of pursuing that, I became acquainted largely through Gandhi in India, who was leading a massive, militant, nonviolent struggle for the independence of his country from the British Empire in the methods of nonviolence. So putting all of those things together, I came to believe that human problems would not be solved, first of all, unless you linked them all and realized that there was some kind of political and human attitude that joined economics and war and daily life. But secondly, that we wouldn't really be posing an alternative to society's ways of dealing things unless we developed nonviolent methods.
In the 1940s, Dave was a resistor to World War II, spent 3 years in prison during the Second World War for refusing to serve in the military.
I think that one of the luckiest things that happened to me was very painful, and that was when I spent 3 years in a federal penitentiary, because I came in touch with the prime victims of society, and I saw, you know, in Plato's phrase, I saw society writ large, in that, because the kid gloves were off, and you saw, you know, not only you got to know intimately the lives of the people, but you saw how the society treated them when they resisted, and where people didn't see how they, what would happen to them as they would be brutalized.
During the 50s, Dave was a leader of the Ban the Bond movement, and also in the civil rights movement in this country during a period of time that's generally assumed to be apathetic and acquiescent. During the 60s, Dave was one of the key leaders of the New Left and of the anti-Vietnam War movement. He was one of the organizers of the mobilizations against the war, the large anti-war demonstrations in Washington during the 60s and early 70s.
The aim in my mind is to maintain solidarity and emphasize the right of the people to liberation.
Dave was one of the organizers at last May 3rd of what is the largest anti-war demonstration in about 10 years in this country against U.S. involvement in El Salvador, the draft, and the vast increases in the military budget.
When 44% of the people born in Latin America, children, die before the age of five from causes attributable to poverty, basically, and to American capital control of the country, they're just as dead as if they'd been killed in a war. And you have to be just as concerned for them as you would for a civilian who was bombed to death.
A conversation with Dave Dellinger tonight on Alternative Views.
Good evening. Welcome to Alternative Views. We have with us tonight Dave Dellinger, who's been described as America's most durable radical. As Ken Carpenter indicated in the discussion, who will also be with us today, Dave has been active for four decades in the movements for peace and social justice in America. So Dave, thanks for coming today. We're very glad to have you. Let's begin by discussing your origins in the peace movement. What led you to resist the draft in World War II? What was your basic pacifist principles there?
Well, actually, it began with the Depression. I grew up in a suburb of Boston. My father was chairman of the Republican Town Committee. And at a certain point, there was the stock market crash when I was a freshman, I think, in high school. And then all of a sudden, according to the philosophy of republicanism and the kind of philosophy that Ronald Reagan symbolizes today, when the unemployment rolls went up from 1 million to 3 million to 6 million, I was led to believe that maybe 5 million people had suddenly become lazy and didn't want to work, and you know, because there were all these jobs available, but they were too fussy or what have you. And this, I think, was my introduction to radicalism. By the way, by radical, I mean going to the roots. You know, that's a Latin word, radix, radicus, right. Roots. And not just putting a Band-Aid on when there's a deep wound, or taking aspirin for cancer and treating the society the same way. But there was also, in the 30s, a very strong, connected with the social justice movement and the movement on behalf of the people who were suddenly thrown out of work or were being evicted from their homes for non-payment of rent or mortgages or whatever it was, there was a strong anti-war movement. And that's one reason I appreciated not the so-called, you know, the praise, but that Ken Carpenter said right off that I identified with or interested in social justice and economic justice as well as anti-war, and I think it's wrong to separate them. Mm-hmm. But in the 30s, they weren't separated, because in the Depression, there was also a lot of exposure about the arms merchants, the merchants of death. Woodrow Wilson had said in a speech that, is there any man, woman, or child in America, any child who does not know that this was an industrial and commercial war relating to World War I? But also, in the course of pursuing that, I became acquainted largely through Gandhi in India, who was leading a massive, militant, nonviolent struggle for the independence of his country from the British Empire in the methods of nonviolence. So putting all of those things together, I came to believe that human problems would not be solved, first of all, unless you linked them all and realized that there was some kind of political and human attitude that joined economics and war and daily life. But secondly, that we wouldn't really be posing an alternative to society's ways of dealing things unless we develop nonviolent methods. But not just methods of, like, I'm not going to be violent, but I'm going to be a pacifist, but I don't care if these black people, you know, have a higher rate of unemployment and a higher incidence of infant mortality and all the rest, but linking them together. And actually, I went to prison the first time and had served a year and a day, was out of prison before Pearl Harbor was attacked. Of course, now we know, and as a matter of fact, I have to say that I knew at the time that the United States had broken the Japanese code, that they had decided, they had already, as a matter of fact, the United States had already been sinking Japanese ships in the Pacific, and they had decided on war, but they maneuvered to try to make Japan make a kind of apparently sneak attack. And I'm not saying that Japan didn't try a sneak attack, mm-hmm. too, but to try something which would turn the country finally against American non-involvement, against America's refusal to think that the way to get rid of fascism and empire in the world was to solve it with bombs and guns and all the rest.
So these have been fairly constant principles from the 1940s up to the present day with you, have they not?
Yes. I mean, you know, like, I'm going to say like anybody, it's like making an excuse. You know, I'm sure that along the way I made mistakes and didn't mm-hmm. handle things correctly, and there's some very difficult problems in life, you know, if you're going to take these things seriously. And one of the most difficult problems comes about when you, or in this case me, but many, many, particularly white middle-class people, which is my origin, at least, are advocates of nonviolence, and then somebody who is terribly, terribly oppressed resorts to some violence in an attempt to free mm-hmm. themselves. Now, one of the things, one of the reasons I sometimes hesitate to call myself a pacifist, although mm-hmm. I'm a total advocate of nonviolent methods, mm-hmm. is that in those situations, sometimes the pacifists say, oh, we can't support the civil rights movement because Robert Williams, who was a leader of the NAACP, has said that Negroes have a right to arm themselves in self-defense. Or we can't support the Vietnamese, or we can't oppose America going over there as the strongest military power in the world and the richest and most powerful country and attacking the peasants. We can't do that because they're fighting back with guns and whatnot. So there are dilemmas. And I never know whether I've made exactly the right decision at the right time, but the aim in my mind is to maintain solidarity and emphasize the right of the people to liberation, and at the same time to concentrate not on whether you agree all the way with their politics or their methods or not, but on in the case of Vietnam, that there is no excuse for the United States to be over there bombing people, uprooting villages, dropping chemicals, all the rest.
So there's
Instead
a right
of saying,
to...
you know, I won't take sides because mm-hmm. both are violent. And mm-hmm. I'm also believe that, and a lot of Vietnamese with whom I've been in close contact feel this too, that the price of defensive military resistance today with modern warfare and modern weapons has become so great. Mm-hmm. And we have by now enough historical examples of the fact that a united people employing nonviolent means can overthrow the worst dictator or the most cruel tyrant, such as happened in Iran, where the people were not nonviolent by choice but by force of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And whatever problems persist there today, and I think there are some very bad problems there, nonetheless, there was a period when the people of Iran, essentially without arms, decided they would not tolerate the dictatorship of the Shah as supported by the United States. And they were able to bring about his downfall. It was only after that, that when they gained control of the army and got arms and so forth, that violence began to come in so seriously on their side.
Dave, in the 1950s, we all experienced the horrors of the atom bomb. Actually, we had the graphic testimony of Hiroshima to show its powerful destructiveness. Did this intensify your commitment to the peace movement and to banning the bomb? Was this a major impact on you, do you think, the fact of atomic weapons and the possibility of nuclear holocaust?
Well, yes, and I should, by the way, just flash back and say the fact that the United States dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki at a time when Japan was desperately suing for peace confirmed at least part of my and other people's reasons for not supporting the U.S. military in World War II, namely that we became, not in superficial cultural detail, but in some core, some essence, United States government became almost like the German government in the sense that it thought it had the right to wipe out these people. And as I say, to wipe them out at a time when Japan was already defeated and was suing for peace, to lie to the country by saying that it was necessary to save American lives, but to do it in order to demonstrate that it held the doomsday weapons in its hand, and in that way it could dominate and control the world and create what Henry Luce of Life magazine called the American century, in which basically the American empire would replace the British empire and the aspiring German empire, and Americans would control the world and basically become number one.
So the bomb really initially confirmed your drive towards the need for radical social change in America. You saw the sort of roots and the sort of militaristic structure of the political economy.
Well, right. The desire to dominate the world, to make all of the world or as much of the world as possible safe for profit for multinational corporations based initially in America. That was the reason basically, or one of the main reasons that they dropped the bomb and developed the hydrogen bomb and tried to maintain nuclear dominance.
Did the horror of nuclear weapons help to radicalize you and to make you a peace activist?
Well, I can. I'm one of the people who can clearly remember being in grade school and having atomic bomb drills where we would all get down under our desks or go out in the hall assuming there was going to be an atomic bomb dropped on our city, and as if we would be protected by hiding under the desk from it. I'm sure that made an impression on me. I also grew up during the period of the Korean War. And I remember that quite clearly. My own radicalization, I think, happened during the Vietnam War, like so many other people in my generation. And really not until the Vietnam War became a very direct immediacy in my life. That is, that I was drafted and knew there was a fairly good chance I was going to be in Vietnam within a few months. That's when I started turning around.
Dave, When did you first become active in opposing the Vietnam War, and what led you to this?
Well, actually, I remember at an Easter anti-bomb march of a coalition in New York, which was one of the largest held up till that time, about 10,000 people. Some people showed up with a sign saying U.S. out of Vietnam. And at that time, I mean, I opposed the U.S. being in Vietnam, but I hardly knew about it, and nobody did. And I always remember, you know...
What year was this now?
Well, I get confused.
62,
but I think, well, 62 is the most apt to be. Mm-hmm. But it was a very minor issue in people's minds. Mm-hmm. It was like they tried to do with El Salvador, you know, we're just sending down whatever
military
it was.
Advisors.
Yeah, advisors and so forth, and they'll be out of there soon. And anyway, the danger of becoming sort of single issue, I remember the... chairperson of that rally, that anti-bomb rally, objected to the presence of these signs because it was introducing an extraneous element. Mm. And I remember turning to him and saying, but Byard, they're opposing U.S. military adventure. How can you say that they don't belong in the anti-bomb rally? And he said, well, that, you know, we all agreed that this is an anti-bomb rally and they shouldn't be introducing that because some people might think that the United States belongs there and mm-hmm. so on. Well, that's sort of a personal incident, I guess. But from then, I developed a heightened interest in it. But people sometimes romanticize the 60s as if it was just a decade in which everybody was out in the streets all the time and it was the thing to do and so forth. I can tell you that from 1961, that incident might have been 61 actually, but from 1961 until 1966 at least, there were five very difficult, lonely years when there were no masses in the streets. And when any time we went out, we were subject to being attacked by angry, quote, patriots, veterans groups, American legionnaires, and all the rest. And it was only because a lot of people, and by the way, this didn't begin even there, it was because people had been in the South in the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. you know, facing the police dogs and the fire hoses and all the rest, and preparing a kind of attitude and developing a kind of a regeneration of what I would consider the best American spirit. It was only through years of that kind of thing that eventually reached the point where as many as a million people would protest throughout the country in the same day against the war.
Dave, what are some of the lessons we can learn from the 60s that are still useful for us in terms of wanting to change American society today?
Well, first of all, I would say that one has to learn that these things do function in a seasonal manner, and that if people had not opposed the Korean War that Ken mentioned at a time when there were no huge rallies and no mass movement, and if people hadn't gone into the South and carried certain values and attitudes and being willing to, if necessary, and in many cases actually sacrifice their lives for it, and if people had said, oh, the whole country supports the Vietnam War, so I'm not going to go out and get my head beaten in, or I'm not going to get my parents angry at me or risk my job and so forth. If people hadn't done that in the non-glory days, so to speak, the movement wouldn't have developed to the extent that it would have. Secondly, though... Let me ask a question on that.
Dave, are you sort of gratified or happy when you see the response of the public today to El Salvador as testimony that all the struggles of the 60s paid off, that here we have another military adventure going on, and in its early stages we were able to mobilize a fairly large number of people for demonstrations and a very impressive public opinion polls against intervention in El Salvador? Does that sort of illustrate what you just said, that the struggles of the 60s weren't in vain and it was the continuity of those struggles that makes it more difficult for America now to get in new military adventures?
Absolutely, and I would add to that that it also shows that the press and the politicians and a lot of people were promoting a false sense of the 70s, mm-hmm. that a lot was going on in the 70s that was very basic, and that if it hadn't gone on, probably the response to the adventure in El Salvador and the growing response, which I anticipate is going to get much, much greater, to the Reagan budget cuts and emphasis of the military and of American machismo, I don't think it would have happened. But yes, that's really one of the lessons of the 60s, I think, is that at the beginning there was what was called the New Left. That is when the movement began to develop in substance at all, around, basically around 1965. And in that time there was a lot of experimental activity. There was no thought that there had to be one single correct way to oppose the war, that everybody had to think the same politically. But there was a great diversity. And when we held teach-ins, if somebody asked a question which said, you know, something like, well, isn't it true that the American advisors are over there only helping the Vietnamese people and trying to introduce democracy to the country? Instead of, well, they'd get a serious answer. And all kinds of questions were discussed and analyzed in a thoughtful way. And there was no pressure for kind of mob opinion that everybody had to think the same. Later it got to the point, although this was not typical of the masses and the movements, but there were too many meetings when if somebody expressed a point of view which deviated a little bit from the organizers of the meeting, they would be ridiculed or condemned or called the enemy or pigs or something.
Which is the worst traits of the old left that the new left initially had
gotten rid of.
Ken, what has been your experience vis-a-vis people's responsiveness to your positions on El Salvador?
Well, I agree with what Dave said totally. I can remember back even in the mid-60s being in anti-war demonstrations in Colorado of 5 or 6 or 10 people. It took years and years of building during the Vietnam War to get the kind of major opposition that eventually, I think, forced the U.S. out of its involvement in Vietnam. It's taken us just a matter of months to organize opposition to U.S. involvement in El Salvador.
And to find quite a response among the population.
That's right. I think one of the things that that we have going for us this time is a pretty broad understanding among the American public about how the U.S. Is maintaining an empire, what the U.S.'s real motives are, the protection of our raw materials, our resources, the things that that we've come to expect the rest of the world to supply us. That wasn't true in the 60s. I think one of the real contributions of the New Left was to give people a kind of analysis of how the American empire really worked, and people understand that now, and they accept that.
I think something else that people understand now that they weren't quite as willing to accept then was that in order to protect this multinational empire, we have to have military alliances with dictators and military mm-hmm. juntas of a repressive sort. And I think Reagan, very cynically and brutally, in his complete rejection of Carter's human rights policy, has made it clear mm-hmm. that the price of this American foreign policy is the support of mm-hmm. military dictators, and I think the people aren't willing to accept it.
Let me just flash back for a minute. You asked at the beginning about World War II. One of the reasons that a lot of people did not support the Americans in American government in World War II was for that very same phenomenon, that although eventually, after first playing footsie with Hitler and contributing to his rise, they apparently turned against fascism, but their allies and the governments that they supported all over the world were, again, the fascist totalitarian governments. And it was just Hitler was singled out as being the one that they were going to get rid of.
Dave, let's move on now to the second lesson of the 60s.
You could become so impatient and so upset over what the United States was doing in Vietnam, not only to the Vietnamese, but the 200 GIs were coming home in canvas bags every week. You know, and you could become so horrified by this that you build up a certain kind of impatience and a head of steam, and you could go out into the streets with hostility mm-hmm. and not reaching out to people, not understanding, and the teach-in was one example, but not understanding that we're all conditioned by this society and that we all have certain attitudes and beliefs, one of them being that the United States is the only democratic good society in the world, or the best at least, and that when it goes abroad, it's doing good things. And so you could go out with a chip on your shoulder toward the people who disagreed with you. And I think that with the danger of nuclear war, really creating the final solution to the world's problems, and you know, in quotes, in terms of the ultimate Holocaust, sometimes people Or people just being so embittered by what's happening to their jobs, by runaway plants and all the rest, that it's possible to become rather narrow in one's attitudes and to carry a kind of hatred and anger into things. Now, anger can be helpful, but hatred can't, I think.
So it leads
to not realizing that we're all in this, you know, confused and fumbling and trying to find our way and sort things out. And it's not where a person is today. He might be in uniform today, suppressing you, but he may also have a lot of reservations and uncertainties. And that it never pays to think, which happened in the late 60s, that that guy is somehow a pig, but to think that he also is a victim and a potential ally, and to try to recruit and work with him, and even though you must defy him at certain points or disobey his orders, that nonetheless you reach out to him as a human being. And that, of course, is one half at least, or one part of the essence of nonviolence.
Is a related lesson from the 60s that things like the Vietnam War shouldn't be seen in isolation as a single issue.
Right.
In other words, a lot of radicals saw the war, or not really radicals, but a lot of protesters saw the war as an absolute evil. When it was over, therefore, the problems would be solved and over. Whereas I think in your perspective, you see the war as expressive of a sort of root causes and a situation in American society that needs to be addressed. So would that be a lesson of the 60s, that one can have single-issue politics, be it anti-nuclear energy or anti-war policies, but one has to see how these are related to the whole systemic situation?
Yeah, the poet Kenneth Patchen, speaking of the anti-war movement of his day, once said, "The trouble is they want to get rid of war without getting rid of the causes of war." But it's not only that. When 44% of the people born in Latin America, children, die before the age of 5 from causes attributable to poverty, basically, and to American capital control of the country, they're just as dead as if they'd been killed in a war. And you have to be just as concerned for them as you would for a civilian who was bombed to death.
So in terms of the lessons of the 60s, we saw that the anti-war movement was there, that took place there, was effective not only in stopping the Vietnam War, but building up a consensus and a basis to stop later imperialist interventions. But we saw that some radicals tended to be a bit too fanatic or too dogmatic, and not really to address the population as allies in the project of social change. And we saw that a lot of people focused too much on one-issue politics, thinking that the Vietnam War in itself was the evil of American society, when once it went away, the problems would be solved. Would you like to comment on that a bit more?
Yeah, I'd like to give an example. For example, the anti-war movement grew not just, anti-Vietnam War movement, not just out of the anti-bomb movement, but out of the experience in the South of the civil rights struggle. And there came a time, I'll just condense this, but there came a time in late 1966 and particularly late 1966, when large numbers of people were getting out in the anti-war movement, and we were beginning to develop a vigorous movement. And we had always had strong black participation, and I'm speaking of the actions, in particular the Mobilization Committee to End the War. And I came into a continuation committee meeting once, it was in New York, about 100 people, and our treasurer proposed that we stop talking so much about black needs and black problems and having so many black speakers, because he said, you know, that's just adding a second issue and some people really don't go with that, and we have a chance to stop the war if we get the masses of the people with us. We rejected that, and interestingly enough, in many ways a good man, he resigned, because he felt we were making a mistake to emphasize black problems at the same time with the war. Simultaneously with that, I, along with a number of other people, had been trying for years to get Martin Luther King to come out against the war. Now, he was an advocate of nonviolence, a leader of nonviolent movements and in the civil rights struggle, and he had been wishy-washy on the issue and had never taken part in a demonstration against the war in Vietnam. And when the point arrived when K- King finally, with a lot of pressure, including from less well-known people, less favored by the media, like SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and other black leaders had really taken the lead in speaking out against the war. And finally, Martin Luther King decided that he would take part in our demonstration in April of 1967. We went to a fundraising party for King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and some of his funders came up to him and said, if you march in that demonstration, Martin, we are withdrawing our funds. And as a background for that, not only what they thought, but what had been going on in the several years that we'd been talking with King and trying to persuade him to take a strong stand, people had said, well, you know, the issue of civil rights is difficult enough, but if you come out against the war too, then they will accuse you of being unpatriotic and not supporting your country. And so, with the best of intentions, he, just like on the other end, some anti-war people wanted to keep quiet about civil rights. He didn't want to, but he did keep quiet about the war. Well, I think that King, who was an honorable, moral person, reached the point where he could be silent no longer, and he took part. And he understood, I think, how in our society he'd been co-opted by the press and by the government, beginning with John F. Kennedy. And he linked not only war and race, but also economics. And he began to organize the Poor People's Campaign, which is going to bring all of these issues together. All oppressed people in the country were going to come together, American Indians and blacks and poor whites and, you know, people suffering from the war and so forth. And I believe that when he did that, and because he did have the charisma and the power and had been built up by the media because they thought they could use him at that point, there was the potential of a united movement that really would have turned the country around or done much more than was accomplished. And 1 year after he appeared in our April 4th, 1967 march, or April, actually it was April 7th, 1 year later, less 3 days, he was dead because he united those things. I think that show, I offer that as a kind of condensed summary, not only of the problems, the temptations to isolate one issue, right, but also the potential power when they are all brought together, and the realization of people very high in this country of how they could be united, and that they had to get rid of King for that reason.
Well, I think one of the other things that really prevented the rise of that kind of unifying of issues and unifying of people during the New Left was the question of sectarianism, the tendency in the both in the American left and I think also, unfortunately, in the American peace movement to fractionalize into sectarian groups that spend their time battling with each other. And I've also been a little distressed to see that kind of phenomena beginning to rise again in people who are working against the draft, who are working against U.S. involvement in El Salvador, the Reagan budget cuts.
These issues are really linked. And
yeah,
we have to work together in addressing these problems.
Yeah, and I'd like to ask Dave what kinds of things he thinks can be done to unify people so that we don't split up again into wrangling sectarian groups.
A sort of movement-building strategy. That's one thing about the 60s. Finally, there evolved what was called the movement,
right,
which encompassed a variety of these groups.
Well, I think that first of all, you do have to establish the linkages to understand that the way, beginning with the Roman Empire, at least that's where I first learned it, you know, that the rule was divide and rule.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we divide ourselves, then we're doing the system's work for it. Secondly, I think we do have to adopt this spirit of solidarity and diversity. And to think, it comes back to the idea that there's just like one path to truth or one road to revolution or one vanguard group, which is usually my group, of course, you know, whoever I am, that has the answer. To learn that in nature there isn't one flower that is the most beautiful or one tree that's the most magnificent or one river or anything. It's all contributes to the total the total organism, really. And that to build a new society, we have to start with the assumption of multiplicity and diversity, but at the same time establish the links and establish the solidarity. So instead of going into a coalition and trying to caucus, I mean, caucuses can be fine if they're open and not don't try to dominate, but instead of caucusing, going in and trying to get everybody to think like I think, or everybody to take the action that I feel like taking, that one has to maintain this openness and to know that real science operates by trial and error and experiment, rather than telling some person, you know, from on high or from science what the truth is. And so you've got to allow people to try different things. And you've got to, by process of trial and error and by many people doing different things, build kind of a united strength. There's a whole emphasis which there really isn't time to go into, but a kind of a decentralism which, well, I would say, interestingly enough, the women's movement in a way where they have stressed that the personal is the political, you know, that reduces things to human scale. And really, by reducing, it doesn't mean it makes them less real or less valuable. It makes them more real more valuable. And the anti-nuclear movement with its decentralist emphasis, where people take care of business where they are. On the other hand, if I could just say one more word on it, Paul Goodman, who said something very important, I think, that people at the most vital areas of their life must live in face-to-face communities and face-to-face relationships where they are accountable and other people are accountable. But he said you also have to become both more local and more global at the same time. And when people say to me, as they're beginning to do again, as they did in the late 60s, which do you favor, local action or national action? I always say, well, that's like asking me which I favor, breathing in or breathing out. If you don't do both, you're in trouble. If you don't have national demonstrations where people can get a sense of the strength and the massiveness of the movement, and that they're not just some kooks, as locally people will try to convince them, on the, you know, you lose something. But if, on the other hand, you have just event after event in Washington or some other place, and people aren't doing the hard, nitty-gritty, grassroots daily work of transforming their lives and transforming their neighborhood and transforming everything from their love relationships to their work relationships to the community growth, development, all the rest. If they're not doing that, why, the national demonstrations become more and more narrow and more futile.
So it's almost as important, as the issues that we're working on are the preserving that kind of politics of openness, that kind of experimentalism, and that kind of flexibility.
Okay. And working, I think, simultaneously. See, another one of these things, like, are you for local or national? Is, do you think that first you must change people or change the society, change the institutions? You can't change the institutions except by changing the people, but you can't change the people if you're changing themselves in a vacuum without relationship to the daily institutions. They've it's got to go on simultaneously.
Ken, you told me earlier this week in a conversation that you thought what was exemplary about Dave Dellinger as a longtime movement activist was his openness, his flexibility, and his ability to build bridges between different groups.
Yeah, and the other thing I'd add is just a good dose of common sense, of being able to look at a situation and understand what's going on in a very simple, clear way.
But I want to interrupt, because I get a little nervous about this. I think what's so terribly important is not to make heroes of people, because,
sure,
like, I am older and therefore been involved longer, but I can tell you that in 1965, when the New Left began to flower, I learned more from the New Left from, or I don't know, why be competitive about it, I learned as much from the New Left as the New Left learned from me. And one of the things that has to happen is that we have to break down the ageism. Young people, every generation comes with new insights, or insights that we've forgotten. On the other hand, people who have been around longer and experienced certain things have certain understandings and insights which are also part of the picture. So we must, all of us, simultaneously both teach and learn.
What are some,
forgive the interruption.
Well, what we'd like you to continue on are some of the bridges that should be built, some of the links between different movements.
Well, one of the advantages that we have now, again, compared to the 60s, is the broader range of people we're working with when we're talking about U.S. opposition to involvement in El Salvador, for instance. Now we're talking about labor unions being very involved. We're talking about a whole large veterans movement. In the 60s, there were no veterans who were on our side, or very few.
Well, there were some who were generated out of the war, but there weren't previous.
At the beginning, there were very few.
Sure. So we're just working with a whole broader range of people now. And that calls for, I think, a lot more sensitivity and a lot more understanding of how issues are interrelated, and a lot more willingness to be open and to listen to people who are different than you and to learn from them.
Are you encouraged by some of the linkages that you've seen in recent years in the anti-nuclear movement or in the movement against El Salvador, et cetera?
Yes, there's a long way still to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy. You know, it's like the neatest trick of the decade to be able to continue focusing on your own oppression, and that's one of the things the women's movement taught us, that you can't say to any group or to yourself, well, this oppression can wait while we fight against that one. You've got to be, again, that's what openness and honesty means, is not accepting oppression for yourself or anybody else. But it's the neatest trick of the decade if we can maintain that and at the same time maintain united actions and, you know, keep the two things happening together. And it's not, I think the movement is in that direction now. More and more people realize that everything is linked. It's all sort of a matter of a common economy and common assumptions and attitudes that cause the problems in whatever area of life. But although more and more people realize that, there are still breakdowns occurring, you know, where suddenly people of one race are excoriated in an argument like in the El Salvador question that really where race is not the issue, or where women are made once again to feel inferior, you know, step back a little bit and let we men who, you know, make a better appearance on television or you know, it's like the old Martin Luther King civil rights anti-war thing all over again. So that does crop up. It has to be tackled.
Dave, a lot of commentators and people that look at America today saw the 1970s as sort of an apathetic, passive, quiescent decade, and then saw this culminated with a victory of the new right and Reaganism in 1980, with Reagan claiming he has a mandate for his problems. Do you share this view of both the 1970s and American society today? How do you perceive this?
Well, first of all, you see, I think that the spirit with which one does something is as important as the goals for which one, the spirit and the means, as the goals for which one is working. And I think that toward the end of the 60s, because it was an emergency period and because people did suffer a lot and people were impatient, there was a kind of a harshness and a shrillness and a lot of loss of perspective that tended to creep in. And a lot of what has been derided as narcissism and going off in a corner and meditating and forgetting the world, I think was a very important reaching out for deeper roots and understandings and getting... You know, the phrase used to be about getting your head clear or getting your values in order. Now, to the extent that those tendencies, those needs were prostituted by authoritarian gurus or by money-making charlatans or, you know, people who had a, you know, like they say of some therapist that they have a need for disciples, so they'll keep you as a patient as long as they can. To the extent that that happened, obviously it was deplorable, and it did happen. But in the same way, I wasn't about to give up politics because they developed a cult of personality in politics, and because a lot of left groups and even a country like the Soviet Union developed some very repressive means of dealing with people. So I didn't say, well, there's no hope, we'll just go with what we've got, which is capitalist cynicism and so forth. And in the same way, I think that it was wrong to throw out the whole search for some kind of, sometimes these words aren't popular, but some kind of pure approach to life and less egocentric approach, and, you know, to get rid of the ego in the manner that the Buddhists advocate, and I guess any true religion does. I don't think that either should be abandoned, because sometimes it was taken advantage of by charlatans or by people who just didn't understand fully. So I see the 70s as a very important period of preparing the way for what I hope will be a very strong, militant, insistent political movement, which at the same time does maintain some, well, old-fashioned words, but the spirit of love and cooperation and sensitivity to other people, which will unite unite these values in a way that we didn't we haven't always done in the past.
Do you think that the new right really has a mandate for their programs that go against everything that you just said, this anti-ERA, anti-abortion, anti-social change, anti just about even television? Or do you think that this is just a sort of marginal thing?
No, you see, even after as many as a million people protested the war in the last years, when an overwhelming majority of the country opposed it, they still tried to talk about the silent majority or the middle American majority who supported the war. Now they speak about the moral majority. Well, by now I think that's been exposed quite a bit. And Reagan claims a mandate for views which are horrendous for most people, not as they are described in certain generalized ways, you know, where, you know, when he speaks about America getting strong again, you think of the, you know, the early colonists who stood behind a tree with a musket to fight off the redcoats, you know, in a world where that's not true. But in fact, only 26% of the eligible electorate voted for Ronald Reagan, or slightly less than 26%, I think. And of those, many, many people voted for change, not for the kind of repressive policies that are coming in, because they didn't have jobs, or because they were getting destroyed by inflation, or because they were worried about the danger of war and the hypocrisy of the preceding, and as well as the inefficiency and ineffectiveness of the preceding administration. So actually, I think that a lot of, said, I don't want to oversimplify anything, many people are unhappy, alienated from the existing institutions, tending to get discouraged, not knowing what to do about it. But I think that at the same time, there is the potential amongst those people for embracing new ideas and new methods, and for understanding that the society is so sick and so out of whack that we have to try a lot of new things. And as Reagan's methods obviously fail, I think that there's hope that people will begin to extend into larger relationships the relationships that they've developed in smaller groups now. You know, in their family, you know, love relationships, in communes, in little organizations and groups.
So you see the possibility for another mass movement for social change in American society that could lead to a revitalized left.
Yes, the only thing is I get slightly afraid of the word mass. I think it can be massive and large and extensive. But I think that if it only operates as a mass, then, you know, this quality which the 70s helped develop in the country and in the movement, and there's a danger of its being lost.
Dave, as a final question, what has kept you going for these 4 decades? What are your deepest hopes, or what values have you been striving to realize, or what faith has just kept you going day to day in all these different movements and struggles?
Well, I could say a lot of things probably. One of my was interesting. I was with somebody about 10 years older than I was, and he was asked that question. And he said, you know, don't you get discouraged? Why don't you act differently? He says, well, can you think of any better way to live? In other words, living, relating to people in a positive way and trying to fight for those values. But I could also say that I think that one of the luckiest things that happened to me was very painful, and that was when I spent 3 years in a federal penitentiary, because I came in touch with the prime victims of society, and I saw, you know, in Plato's phrase, I saw society writ large, in that, because the kid gloves were off, and you saw, you know, not only you got to know intimately the lives of the people, but you saw how the society treated them when they resisted, and where people didn't see how they what would happen to them as they would be brutalized. And I think from that time on, I've learned that even though you must, everybody must try to achieve a certain amount of solitude and privacy and quiet and not just be constantly on the barricades, you know, reflectiveness and so forth, they have perspective, closeness with nature. At the same time, you cannot live substantially what I'll call an upper class life in isolation from the victims of society and maintain a proper perspective. And partly beginning with the friendships I made in jail, you know, I guess I've been constantly in touch with black people whose anger gets communicated and whose sufferings, and with American Indians and Mexicans and poor whites and all the rest. And I think that if one is not becoming too academic or too kind of the way a certain political sect that Ken refers to, getting lost in what Lenin says or Marx says, or or if you're more religious in what some religious figure said.
Gandhi.
But exactly. Gandhi is a beautiful example of that, you know, where it can lead people astray. Mm-hmm. If you are in touch with the people who are living, working, and suffering, and you're not taking the easy way out of living in isolation from them, they drive you. You can't say, oh, well, I'm tired of all this now. I don't feel like demonstrating today. If you are in touch, you know, with young black children growing up in the ghetto of Brooklyn, which is what my own life experience at this point.
Well, you have traveled to Vietnam, to Cuba, to Iran, and seen some of these situations of oppression and struggle, have you not? Has that also been part of this, touching the people and experiencing their needs and struggles?
That's right. I mean, I often think of what Susan Sontag said when she visited Hanoi and North Vietnam during the war and walked through the territory. At first, she was very disappointed in them because she felt pity for them, and they didn't seem to feel any pity for themselves. And secondly, because they used words like imperialism and colonialism and capitalism, and she'd only heard those words used in a rhetorical sense and kind of with a kind of hostility. But after she'd been there for a while, she realized two things. One, that when they spoke of imperialism and colonialism, they were speaking from their life experience. And secondly, that they were better off than the people at her home in America, even as they were dying and suffering all the things which had to be stopped, but because they knew at that point what they were fighting for, and they were fighting for values which were stronger than the individual. And I think that when I have gone to third world countries, sometimes I disagree with their politics or their tactics on a particular thing, but one gets a sense of this great upsurge of life, you know, of people who are determined no longer to be the patsies in a situation when the United States, with 4% of the world's population, speaks of its right to consume 40% of the world's resources. As the Reagan, Caspar Weinberger, yesterday was quoted in the paper, and it's just a typical quote, of the importance of the United States preserving access to its strategic resources in the Persian Gulf.
As if the world was just an oyster bed for the United States to feed upon.
Right.
Well, Dave Dellinger, Ken Carpenter, thank you very much for coming and for the conversation today, and thank you both for being. Good night.
Thank you very much.
Our bedtime story tonight takes the form of a commentary which we have from one of our alternative press, and you may be surprised at the end where I tell you where it comes from. He talks about the rapid deployment force, the U.S. relationships with the Soviet Union, the business interests involved, and he says that Americans may be a little bit confused, wondering why, for instance, that the British, who have joined the Reagan administration in this virulent anti-communism, now are trying to woo the Soviet Union to get as much business as they can to try to become involved in the Soviet's new five-year plan. Plus the fact that the American corporations are involved with $2.5 billion worth of help to the Soviet Union in developing the natural gas projects of the Soviets in Siberia.
It doesn't make a difference if they're angry at the Soviets for the Afghanistan situation. They want some of the money for themselves. So how is this to be reconciled? The author of the report here says that there are at least two good reasons for wondering whether there really is concern over Soviet expansionism that's really responsible for all this business of such enthusiasm for proceeding with worldwide interventionism on the part of the United States. He says that the advocacy of this idea is made a part of the alleged need for the West to be in a position to combat Soviet adventures in the Persian Gulf. And yet, on the other hand, he noticed that the Soviets have really acted with a great deal of restraint in that area. Not only do they not want to endanger their relationships with the United States and possibly start a war, but they're also concerned that if there were intervention in the Middle East and the United States came in and there were a war and a lot of problems, that it might create such economic instability in the West that it could also disrupt economic and political relationships with the Soviet Union and the Soviet bloc countries. So the author goes on to say, while it is true that the creation of such interventionist mechanisms as the Rapid Deployment Force was first proposed back when they were originally targeted not against the Soviet Union, but against third world insurrections or instabilities, such as the disruption of the oil supplies or even overthrows of government. Anything that would disrupt the present relationships of the multinational corporations. So what emerges is that the main purpose for the projected new international interventionist mechanisms may be to serve as an aid to the onward march of big business imperialism. The emphasis placed by official explanations on the part that they would play in combating Soviet interventionism or adventurism would be to deflect the third world from what it would see as an extremely unpleasant truth. Now, the reason for this is that they already have been problems, that the Gulf states don't want to be the objects of U.S. protection. They've said this themselves. They don't like the idea of the Rapid Deployment Force treating them as the prime target. So the correspondent here concludes by saying that the people of the West, whose husbands and sons will be doing the fighting for the new cause, should do some deep thinking about it too, while there is still time to put a stop to the economic imperialists' plans. Now, is this some wild-eyed writer from Communist Daily Worker or something like that? No. It's an economic expert who writes for our right-wing newspaper, The Spotlight. Good night.